Let's start with character and leadership. When you start to follow Christ, one of the things you discover fairly quickly is just how exciting it is to experience the love of God flowing through you into other people's lives. Some of the most intense, ecstatic experiences I've ever had were during serving Christ. And, you know, coming from a background as somebody who is always seeking stimulation, drug experiences, experiences in the world, and then to come over and just start to serve Christ and you start to discover just how incredible this can be, it's powerful. And there's nothing wrong with that. Jesus himself said, if you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. Makes you happy, makes you feel fortunate, it's exciting. Jesus says it's better to give than to receive. You're more blessed, happy. There's a danger, however, in this. When you start to get one or two or seven, eight, 12, 20 of these experiences, your walk with Christ can start to become all about experiences like this. And so very tacitly, you start to look for the fruit of serving Christ rather than just being found faithful, being content in faithfulness. Now, that being said, sometimes fruit and faithfulness are the same. If you're faithful, you will bear fruit. For example, think of Galatians chapter 6, verse 9, where Paul says, "Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap if we do not grow weary." So being faithful to the work of God and abiding in Him, Jesus promised, if you abide in me, you will bear fruit, period. Yet, there's a sense in which fruit and faithfulness are distinct. They're different. Think of Paul, 2 Timothy 4, verse 2, "Preach the word, be ready in season and out of season." He wouldn't say be ready unless this was something that would kind of blindside us as Christian workers, that there could be times where you're preaching the word, you're doing the work of the Lord, where you're in season. And these are great times. They're exciting. It's fun. You're just seeing answers to prayer left and right. And then yet there's other times you're out of season in your work. And he says you got to preach the word either way. Think of the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah. Isaiah, tough duty. Isaiah 20. God tells him that he has to strip naked for 3 years. 3 years duty. That must have been hard. Jeremiah, same thing. I mean, when Isaiah gets his call, God says, "Whom shall I send?" He says, "Me." And he says, these people will keep hearing but not listen. They'll keep looking but not see. Their hearts have grown hardened. And he says, how long is this going to last? And he says, until the very end, until the exile. Isaiah 6. Isaiah says, I'll go. Now today, we see that his ministry bore an incredible amount of fruit. Every time you appeal to Isaiah's messianic prophecies, you discover that his ministry was incredibly, incalculably important. And yet there's a sense in which it's not like some kind of a mechanism where I pump in faithfulness and turn the crank and out pops fruit. That's just not true. And so we need to be careful. It's possible for God to use you even when you're not being faithful, even when you're not close with Him at all. Think of Jesus' statement in Matthew chapter 7 where these people come to Him and they say, "Lord, did we not prophesy in Your name? Did we not cast out demons in Your name? Didn't we do all these great works in Your name?" And Jesus says, "I never knew you. Depart from me." It seems to follow that those people whom Jesus was speaking to were not Christians. Yet, you're telling me that God can use a non-Christian to perform miracles, prophesy, cast out demons? Yeah, He can do that. He can speak through Balaam's ass if He wants to. The donkey I'm referring to, of course. He can do that. If He wants that to be His messenger, He can. And He can use you and me. So, there's a problem in a sense that we could think that just because God is using me to bear fruit, therefore I'm close with Him. And you see, that doesn't follow. That's not necessarily true. And so, where am I going with this? What's the point? You're saying it could be exciting to follow Christ, and yet, There could be times where it's not that exciting, and fruit and faithfulness aren't the same, and closeness with God and bearing fruit aren't always the same. That's exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, when it comes to Christian leadership, there's a firm bedrock of character that needs to be in place. Character is what makes us effective over the long haul. You've heard of the Aesop's fable of the tortoise and the hare? Not important. The point is that the hare runs until he burns out. The tortoise, slow and steady, finishes the race. And that's the goal. The goal for each one of us, each one of you, isn't that you would think that you're in some kind of a 50-yard dash to serve the Lord as hard as possible for the next 6 months. The goal is that you would become a man or a woman of character who could serve the Lord faithfully until the end. There's many people that you look at who started off really strong, people whom you would admire, and then toward their middle ages and beyond, they totally lose it. Some of the best authors that you read went totally wacky at the end of their lives. I mean, there would just be a litany of names we could go through. People who were serving the Lord and the message of grace and the word, you know, they couldn't live off of the bread and butter of what it means to be a believer. And so they get into all these exotic either theologies, sinful practices, whatever, materialism, I don't know. But it's just not as exciting as it used to be. Here's John Maxwell. He's an author who's widespread on the subject of leadership. He says we have no control over a lot of things in life. We don't get to choose our parents. We don't get to select the location or circumstances of our birth and upbringing. We don't get to pick our talents or our IQ. But we do choose our character. He's right about that. I've prayed to have certain giftings given to me by God. I've pled with him. Wish I had that gift. Wish I was better at this. And he said, no. That's not in your control. If I want to give you that gift, I can. I might not. You don't get to choose your upbringing. You don't get to choose your IQ. And yet you do get to choose what kind of a person you want to be in the Lord. Bill Hybels, who writes quite a bit on the subject of sustainability, the notion that you're living a lifestyle with the Lord, something which you can sustain with his help throughout your entire life. He tells story after story of friends of his who completely lost it. They fell into affairs. They fell into stealing, theft, burnout, just complete neurosis, collapse, anxiety fits. They call it overheating, like when your car, the radiator blows to keep you cool, and they just totally lose it. Hybels, one thing I respect about him is that he's never lost it. He might be a little bit overboard. He schedules in a 3-month sabbatical every summer where he completely leaves his duties and goes and does sailing out on the lake by himself with his family. Sounds pretty nice. He answers email. He does phone calls, Skype, but he steps away for 3 months every year. That might be too much, and yet on the other hand, this guy is in his 60s still serving the Lord, and God's still using him. He writes this, "How's your heart? If you stay on the track that you're on, will your heart grow bigger as the ministry years go by? Or are your margins too thin?" This isn't going to speak to all of us, but for those of us who are drivers, working hard, overworking, overheating, margins refer to those downtimes throughout your week, where for somebody who's kind of a type A driver, go, 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 if you schedule 100% of your week, what happens when something comes up? What happens when you get sick? What happens when a loved one needs you? What happens with this or that? Richard Svensson, he says that we should schedule our weeks 80%, 90%, and leave these margins. For people who are driven, they're going to use that time. But if you schedule everything from morning until night and you have nothing in between, those are thin margins. You're going toward burnout. Are you running so fast that by the time you reach periodic finish lines, you're a depleted wreck? Please face what you need to face. Change what you have to change. Experiment with life management practices that will allow you to excel at leadership and excel at loving. That's some good wisdom. Often the thing that we want to cut isn't the thing we should cut. When you look at your schedule, it could be possible that you're overscheduling ministry. That's always a possibility. It could also be that you're overscheduling all of this frivolous stuff in your life that you need to cut. In the name of Jesus, you need to cut it. And cut that out and leave times for you and the Lord. Leave times of relaxation where it's just you two enjoying your walk with Christ. He calls it life management practices. I don't like that. Sabbath. That's what we would call it. Sabbath. Gifting and charisma are like the muscle of a person. You look at those hot pecs, those popping traps, those solid glutes. But character is like the backbone. You know what steroids do to a person? Well, they do many things. They accelerate your muscle growth beyond your bone growth. What do I mean by that? It means that your muscles can lift more weight than your skeletal structure can hold. And so think of the example of an Olympic weightlifter. He gets that weight up over his head. And if you're squeamish, don't look at this next picture. His bone just snapped. There's another angle in case you wanted more. Okay, we're done with that. Okay, one more time. Look at that. Ah! Oh, that's a pretty gruesome picture, isn't it? Far less gruesome than when you see a Christian leader take a complete nosedive. At least there's physical therapists for something like that. There's skilled surgeons. And yet when you see a Christian leader go down publicly in flames, the ripple effect that that has to that person's people that are close to them, they've served. Oh, you cannot believe the shock wave. And it's because of character. There wasn't character. So you could be comparing yourself to another believer just wondering, why am I not at her stage or his stage? Whatever. Who cares? You're your stage. You're where the Lord wants you, and He's developing your character. Oh, when are people going to recognize me? Don't worry about that. Think less about that. Think more about, is God teaching me something? Am I learning from Him? Gifting without character brings an odious shame on the name of Christ. People like this, they fall into all sorts of addictions. One of the things they've discovered, many of the highest percentage of alcoholics are some of the gifted, most gifted people you've ever met. But they never feel like they're good enough. They always feel like, I'm so gifted, I'm so special, and yet I can't live up to what I think I have a potential for. And so it just leads further into this spiral. They're not happy with themselves. They're not content. They don't have the joy of the Lord. What else are they going to do? They're going to fall into something that brings stimulation. People like this, they can turn into pushy, manhandling, manipulative leaders. If they're not seeing fruit, they're going to make fruit. It's Chuck Smith's illustration of the garden versus the factory. In a factory, you're pumping out the line. You're making, stamping those widgets, stamping those bolts, pieces and parts. You're producing something. Factories are filled with steam and smoke and sweat. Gardens are not this way. Gardens, you come out, you do have a role, and yet your role is to water, to observe, maybe to do some weeding, and then you just watch the fruit grow. Gifting without character leads to the factory, trying to push, 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 manipulate fruit creators. And this whole picture just leads to a loss of rewards, spiritual rewards. Think of 2 John 8, where John says he's in context referring to false teaching, these antichrists coming into the church. And he says, be careful that you do not lose your reward. Some people think that spiritual rewards are, if I do such and such a thing out of faithfulness, then it's stored up for me in heaven. Can't be touched. Think of what Jesus said, Matthew 6:21. You know, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust can destroy. So they have the view that if I do a bunch of faithful things, then that's immutable. It's stored up for me. There's another perspective which says that, yeah, God does reward. He rewards you based on the faithfulness of your entire life. Not just based on, well, I followed the Lord for a couple years and did some faithful things, and then I spent the next 50 years not following him at all. God is going to be gracious. Read Matthew 25. When Jesus is dishing out the reward, some of the people are there like, when did we ever serve you when you were naked, hungry, thirsty? And he said, if you gave it to one of the least of these, you gave it to me. Apparently, he's going to be incredibly gracious, and yet he's looking for faithfulness. Could this happen to me? Not I, Lord. I would never deny you. Peter, you will deny me this very night. That wasn't the last fall that Peter had either. He was on the wrong end of the decision to bring the gospel out to the Gentiles, Acts chapters 10 and 11. He's telling God no. God said, kill and eat. And it was a symbol for bringing the gospel to the Gentile peoples, Cornelius' family. And Peter said, may it never be. He messed up in Antioch. Paul, Galatians 2:11-14, it says that he had to rebuke him. Why? Because he wasn't walking in the truth of the gospel. That's why. An apostle. We could louse up. The question is, are we looking out for this? Are we looking at our margins? Are we checking our heart? Are we waiting for this? Are we helping each other? Is there going down the wrong path? We're speaking in, watching out. And so tonight we want to just spend the rest of our time looking at the subject of character. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1 are the passages, central passages on qualifications for elders and for deacons. Qualifications for deacons actually only come in 1 Timothy 3. Qualifications for elders come in both passages. 1 Timothy 3 verse 1 reads this way. It says, it is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. To desire, the Greek term arego, not oregano, arego. BDAG defines it as to seek to accomplish a specific goal, having a goal, not antithetical to grace. Goals are not antithetical to grace. Well, what about if you have a goal of being an elder? Not antithetical to grace. He says if you aspire, seek to accomplish a specific goal, aspire to, strive for, desire. Oh, that's so prideful. You'd want to ever be an elder or a deacon. That's not prideful. That's the opposite of prideful. If you would want to have these kind of character qualities in your life, if you would like to have this kind of influence as a servant leader, that is the opposite of pride. That is servanthood. That is humility. Wanting to be in that kind of a role, not the crown of gold, but the crown of thorns. It's a fine work he desires to do. 2 Corinthians 10:13. Paul writes, we, however, will not boast beyond our proper limits, but will confine our boasting to the field God has assigned to us. God assigns ministry. Think of how many times we read Paul desired to finish his course. John the Baptist, Acts 13, was finishing his course. Acts 20, I need to finish my course. Timothy, finish your course. God assigns us. God places us. He places each member in the body just as he desires. 1 Corinthians 12:18. And so for him to have these good works prepared beforehand for us and for us to say no, no, that is not humble to say no to the Lord. What our correct response when God asks us a question is to say yes and then say, what was the question again? Yes, Lord, absolutely. Yes, sir. Saying the words, no, Lord. It's like saying a married bachelor. Those two words do not belong in the same sentence. Aspiring to the office of overseer. We touched on this earlier. What is the difference between an overseer and an elder? Episkopos, overseer, epi, above, skopos, to see. Or presbyteros, an elder. Two different terms. Not that difficult to understand. Overseer is an elder. Elder is an overseer. How do we know that? Well, think of Acts 20, verse 17. It says, Paul sent to Ephesus and called to him the elders of the church. That's who I want to have come to the meeting here before I take off. We jump down to verse 28 and it says, be on your guard for yourselves and for all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Oh, I guess the wrong group showed up. Paul wanted the presbyteros and he got the episkopos. Episkopos is presbyteros. Elders are overseers. It's the same thing. Not convinced? Titus 1:5. He says to Titus, I left you in Crete that you would appoint elders in every city, verse 7, for the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward. Paul, I think you made a typo. I think you just called an elder an overseer. He says, I didn't make a typo. They're the same office. As early as the beginning of the second century, you can read this in the works of Ignatius. He has a number of authentic letters which he wrote. We're talking 110 AD. They were already starting to bifurcate the office of overseer and elder. Biblically, they're the same. Overseers, guess who they became? Bishops. Bishops, a bishopric in Latin. An overseer wouldn't just look over his own church, he would oversee multiple churches. Remember last week we discussed that each individual church should have its own church government. It wouldn't be right for us to go over into another church with some kind of leadership authority. It likewise wouldn't be right for them to come over here. We all stand under the word, but what we're saying is, you know, we don't have leadership authority. Well, this concept of overseer brought that in. They started to say, well, an overseer is a bishop, somebody higher than an elder. No such thing. Okay, an overseer, an elder then, must be gifted? That would seem to make sense. I mean, somebody who could look after the church, winsome. That kind of a person who's charismatic, maybe even good looking. Somebody at the front, good speaker. You know, Paul doesn't mention any of these things. What he mentions is a man or woman of character. If we have the right person in that role, a man or woman of character, that is going to be the foundation for leadership. If we were to compromise on this, compromise on character, we could be in a huge heap of trouble. Of course, character is relative to the group. It might surprise you. But think about that for a second. If you're starting a church, think of Acts 14. The church has only been around for a year or two. These new churches, and Paul appoints elders. I mean, we're talking about believers that are a year or two old. Clearly, depending on the age of the group, that would be dependent. I got a question for you. Should an elder in a church in Cambodia, in the third world, should he be able to refute naturalistic scientism? Postmodernism. New Age theology. An elder here in Columbus, Ohio, would you expect him or her to be able to do those things? Absolutely. Titus 1:9 says, not just to exhort in sound doctrine, but refute those who contradict. But why wouldn't we hold out for that in a church in Cambodia, but we would here? Because it's different. It's different. We wouldn't expect that over there. They have different issues that they're dealing with. They might say, well, why aren't you schooled in polytheism and animism, folk Buddhism? Well, that's not something we deal with over here. So it's going to look different. A spiritual age, the character quality should be there, but we just can't make these absolutes, I guess is what I'm saying. Another aspect of an elder or an overseer, which we don't get from this passage, but we do get from 1 Timothy 5:17, is that elders should be able to functionally lead well. They should be good leaders, in other words. Or to put that still a different way, they should have a history of a good leadership record. Paul says to Timothy, the elders who rule well, prohistomai, leadership, are to be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. So it actually seems to me that the emphasis on ruling well comes over the teaching and preaching part. The role of ruling well, leading well, that is it, and he says especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. So this could happen where you have a church where the actual opinion leaders, the leaders of the church, are not those who are in the eldership. The people who are in the eldership are nice people, godly men and women of character, and that's good. And yet the actual leaders aren't making the decisions. So for us, what we want to look for at the home church level, at the fellowship level, we want to look at the people who are leading well. Those are the people that we're recognizing we should get them. We're seeing that there's already fruit there, and it's confirming what's happening in our decision. Verse 2, an overseer then must be above reproach. Above reproach. Let's think about this word here. Anapelepton. It means literally unaccusable. Unaccusable. I'm reading, of course, from the NASB. A very word-for-word translation, and yet sometimes the words can be kind of rigid, honestly. Unaccusable. This cannot mean that they're never accused of anything. How do we know that? Well, one word. Jesus. Jesus was accused of being deranged. Mark 3:21. Deceitful. John 7:12. Drunk. Matthew 11:19. And finally, demon-possessed. Mark 3:22. He was accused of those things. Think of Paul. Paul was slanderously called an antinomian, among other terms. Think of Romans 3:8. He says, we've been slanderously reported to teach this. It wasn't true. The point here is not that you've never been accused. Being accused, I don't want to speak too much. Being accused means far less than if those accusations have any merit. If somebody brings up an accusation, it just completely falls flat. Accusations carry no weight. And so the question that you would ask yourself if you were trying to see if this reflects you is this. Do the people who really know me feel like they can trust me? Do they feel good about following me? Or do they worry that I'm going to let them down? Are they concerned that I'm just one step away from another fall? If an accusation came in, would they be shocked or would they see it coming? Oh, that'd be a scary thought. If you were accused of something and people weren't shocked by that. Above reproach. Second, the husband of one wife. Mes gynekos andros, literally a one-woman man. We talked about this a little bit last week. This is the character quality of having your sexuality under control. So whether you're single, whether you're married, Paul himself was single. He may have been divorced. He may have been a widower. He may have just always been single. Many commentators believe that Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin, which was always for married men. You think he could have been married? The way he talks about marriage in 1 Corinthians 7 makes you think he knows what it's like to be married. He speaks like a formerly married man. But as an apostle, he wasn't. So this isn't referring to singlehood or marriage. It's referring to having your sexuality under control no matter what situation you're in. So areas to check for this, which would be disqualifying for leadership. Porno. Disqualifying. You talk to some people about this, and I do say people, about one-third of the porno industry is women involved in it. It's not just a guy thing anymore, maybe one-quarter. So it's women as well as men, porno. Talking to people who say, well, I'm seeing real victory from porno. That's fantastic. How's it been going? Well, I'm down to, you know, falling into it once a month. That's not victory. Well, I used to be in it every day. Okay, that's progress. That's progress. Good for you. That is awesome. But that's not victory. There's a difference between the two. Making progress versus making victory. If you were drinking till you were drunk every day and then 1 month went by and you didn't drink that whole month and get intoxicated, that would be progress. That'd be awesome. But it's not victory. To get your mind stamped with pornographic images, sounds, visuals, everything. Once a month, we're talking about, we got to see some serious victory here. Flirting. A lot of people don't even realize that they're doing this. They're just kind of friendly, and yet the part where it crosses the line is where you're getting stimulated by somebody of the opposite sex, by ways that you're interacting with them. It doesn't mean you're touching them or whatever. It's just you're flirting. You're sexual innuendos and stuff like that, and you're trying to get stimulation, attention, as a single person or somebody who's dating, or definitely somebody who's married, flirting. I talked to one married man. He went out to a business party the one time. It was like a staff Christmas thing. He said he went out there without his wife, and he was sitting there next to this gorgeous woman whom he worked with, and she was dressed up in the whole nine yards, and he started talking to her, and they're being friendly. He had a beer or two. He just picked up on something there. He wasn't sure what it was, but he was starting to pick up on the fact this is crossing the line. So I said, what'd you do? He said, I went up, I hit the bathroom, I took a minute, asked myself, is this going in the wrong direction? He said, yeah. Came back to the table, said goodbye to people, went home. I admire that. Not when you've actually fallen into sin, and at that point, you know, you have to confess it and get restored, but he could see where this was going. He didn't like it. He was being friendly, but he got up and left. It's a good idea. How's Paul put it? Flee sexual immorality. Yeah. Don't stand firm, you flee. Not having physical boundaries. We should be able to show affection for people of the opposite sex without putting our hands all over them. Affection. Some of the most affectionate times with people, men or women, have been talking, connecting. I mean, I don't want to get into the whole thing of, you know, how far is too far. Should we do the Christian side hug? Do we do the butt out hug? I don't know. I think that's all kind of stupid. But I can show affection for people without having to touch on them all the time. Emotional or physical affairs. Well, that would be an extreme thing. Most of us, when we come to Christ, have no concept for what an emotional affair is. An emotional affair is where you're sharing things with somebody of the opposite sex that you're not sharing with your spouse. John Gottman, who's an expert in marriage counseling, he says, when you start to share things with a woman that you wouldn't share with your wife, that is dangerous territory that you're getting into. Setting up emotional walls, keeping secrets just for somebody else besides your spouse, bad. So, what I'm saying is, no temptation has come upon you that God has given to you that you cannot find a way of escape. 1 Corinthians 10:13. You're going to see as you're moving down the line, okay, here's the exit. Here's the exit. And there is one. God always opens a trap door. You can get out. Open up about this before it wreaks havoc. Temperate. The Greek term here is nephalios. Nepho is the root word. It could just refer to sober. Yeah. Often it refers to alcoholic sobriety. And yet, it can also be translated restrained in conduct, self-controlled, level-headed. So we might refer to somebody as a real sober-minded person, a sober thinker. They're not flying off the handle. Of course, we know that Paul brings up drunkenness later in 1 Timothy 3. Unless he's bringing it up twice, I guess that's a possibility. But for the sake of redundancy, it seems to me that Paul is talking about a different character quality here, one of being level-headed with it. Not having emotional outbursts, not flying off the handle, not doing one thing one week, the opposite the next. Level-headed. So let's open this up for some discussion. How could not being level-headed negatively affect serving the Lord? Why would it be difficult to follow a leader, trust a leader, who wasn't level-headed? What do you think? Yeah. You got some? Yeah. Yeah. We were depending on you to be there. Where were you? Well, I was depressed again, had to sleep through it. Yeah, for 3 or 4 days. Where you been? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. It's going to be pretty difficult, isn't it, to be able to lead people and talk about the stability that comes. Think of Colossians 2, being firmly rooted is the language that Paul uses there. Psalm 1, like a tree firmly planted by the river, stream of water. How am I supposed to convince a younger believer that this is where it's at if I'm flying off the handle emotionally, losing it? Yeah. Yeah, the leader who's constantly changing the vision every month. Dear Lord, just find something, stick with it. You need to keep a steady hand at the wheel. That's what people need, is that there's some stability here. Things could be going crazy, I get it. But people are looking to you to see if you're going to freak out. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've been there where I've had to share some pretty nasty stuff in my life. And to be able to think back, okay, I've shared 3, 4, 5 times here, and they've always met me with grace. Why wouldn't I share this time? However, if we've totally flown off the handle, been totally nuts on somebody, that's going to lead to inhibition. That's going to give them a reason not to open up. Yeah. 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 Oh, yeah. Are we folding? Oh, don't use the F word in this church. So poisonous. And if they, okay, here's an example from parenting, which isn't really analogous because we're talking about adults here, but not kids. But one of the things they say with parenting is that your kids, they learn emotional stability in their, scientifically in their central nervous system, their ability to fluctuate, manage anxiety, fear. They learn that from the parent. And so if you're a neurotic, crazy, hand-washing, germophobic, nutty parent, you're going to produce a neurotic, crazy, germophobic kid. With our kid, he's kind of sensitive. And when he was just starting to walk, he would start to stumble and walk, and he'd fall, and whack, he'd slap his face on the ground. I mean, you would, inside, you would go, you know, it would hurt, like, in your feels, you know? I mean, he would, like, oh, that hurt. And he would immediately look up at you. He's looking to see your reaction. How should I feel? And we got into the habit really early just saying, good fall! Good fall! Man, you hit your face hard! And he'd get up and go, oh, yeah, you know. We readjust his spine, you know, and he'd get up and start walking away. I think there's something true to that with leadership. Things are going crazy, and people are looking to a leader, and they're trying to discover, is this crazy? No, it's not. Everything's okay. It's going to be all right. We're going to trust God here. We don't freak out when this stuff happens. Prudent. Prudent. The word here is sophron. Sophron. Think Sophia, wisdom. The word can be translated thoughtful, sensible, or sane. Sane. Think of Mark 5:15. It says that the demon-possessed man became sophron. Sophron. It doesn't mean he became prudent. It means he became sane, mentally sane. And so that's a regrettable translation. Mental stability is what it's referring to. Areas to check for this. You know, to some degree or another, I have to admit we're all a little bit insane. I know I am. Probably more than most of you. The question is, are you trying to get your complexes under control? Is this something that you're treating seriously? Is it something that has control of you, or do you have control of it? We're all going to have these little things in our life that are disqualifying, that are going to harm us from being able to be reliable as a leader. You got to take care of that. You got to stop screwing around and just managing it, dealing with it, self-medicating. You need to take care of it. Have you seen stability? How long has it been since you had one of your episodes? Are you getting help? Why is it that we have to persuade you to go see a clinical counselor? Because you can't get this under control. Don't you realize this is a big deal? Sophron, get help. Medication. As Christians, we don't believe that we're just purely biological nor purely spiritual. We believe in both. We're dualists. We believe that there's a dual component to what makes up a person. And so there are spiritual issues. Cognitive therapy is based on this, that if you could actually rethink and change your thought patterns, it actually does far more than medication ever could. It's incredible. the studies that have been done on this. Jeffrey Schwartz is one of the pioneers in behavioral cognitive therapy. He's actually helped people with OCD better than medication is concerned. Jeffrey Schwartz. The field is neuroplasticity, where as you start to think differently, it rewires the synapses in your brain, and it starts to get you off into a different direction. So counseling, very helpful. Medication, also helpful. I've seen some good, godly people. They're good, and yet they go through, sometimes in their early 20s, is when some of this stuff starts to come out. You're no longer underneath the skirt of your parents. You're dealing with real stresses. You're out on your own. And these complexes, these anxieties, depression, you name it, start to surface. And I've seen good people get on medication and get things turned around. You know what I've also seen? I've seen people too prideful to take the medicine. And they'll be on it for 6 months or a year, and all of a sudden they just go off it one day. Oh, my God. And you should see the fallout. Going from medication to nothing, it is disastrous. And you're like, why did you do that? Why was it? It wasn't that they got counsel. It's not like they saw a counselor, met with their doctor. They just decided one day, up and quit. I'm just going to stop this. We got to pick up the pieces now. Respectable. Respectable is the word cosmion. Does that word sound familiar? Cosmion. What's it mean? What's cosmos? The world system. You're saying an elder should be like the world system? Sort of. Well, what's the word mean? Cosmetic. Cosmopolitan. That there's a structured order to the city. There's a structured order to the person. Cosmetic. Cosmion refers to, quote, having characteristics or qualities that evoke admiration or delight, an expression of high regard for a person. Respectable. Honorable. Back in the late 90s, most people in our college ministry really struggled with cosmion. It was that generation, Generation X. They were rebellious against their parents, hated their parents, didn't want to be like their parents. It's kind of like the hippies coming out of like the World War II era. I don't want to be like my dad. I don't want to get a Marine haircut. I don't want to work a job, you know, and it was rebellious. And so in our ministry, our job was to convince people, go to school. Get a career, get a trade, do something with your life. You cannot drive pizzas until you're 50, okay? How are you going to provide? Then that started to go pretty good, and we saw a cultural shift, really the millennial generation. That's you guys, where things started to shift, and millennials were all about the cosmos. They wanted to get the best career. They would sacrifice anything for it. Now we're starting to see a shift in the other direction again. So now, in my estimation, things are pretty muddled. You have some people that are going all out for a career, and they're leaving God in the dust. Then you have other people that you're pleading with, brother, please do something here. Get a career, get training, get a certification, something. And they won't do it. I remember talking to one guy years ago, 10 years ago. He was 30. He was still delivering pizzas. I kept asking him, what are you going to do when you fall in love? You start having kids, get married. What are you going to do? No plan. So we would keep urging him, okay, get a 2-year degree, get this certification, get that, just something where you're building, moving toward a goal. And he would do it right up until the point where he actually had to put down some money. You know what I'm saying? Did you go to the orientation? Yeah. Did you get online? Yeah. Did you look it up? Yeah. Did you put down any money? For enrollment, never. He had gone through this dance game with us probably about a dozen times. It wasn't just me, it was other people he'd been in group with. Well, at the time, I remember warning him sternly. I said, you're going to be in trouble if you don't turn this around. Well, now, 10 years later, he's in the exact same spot. Only now, he's looking down the wrong end of 40, hasn't had anything put together. And just in case you think, well, I'm just going to do ministry, I'm going to serve the Lord, this doesn't matter. This is going to affect your ability to serve the Lord if you don't get your life in order. Areas to check. Being able to hold a job. Let's just start small. You know, are you able to go to work? Get out of bed. Set your alarm. Wake up for it. Not having to set three alarms and not being able to get up for any of them until, like our one buddy, could not get up. He bought an alarm that was made for deaf people, so you could set it at a different pitch, like a wee, and you could set it to a pitch that was audible to the deaf person. So he had that in our house. And my buddy, roomed with him. He used to have an airsoft gun on the top bunk. And our friend wouldn't wake up to the alarm, but he would wake up to the cocking of that gun. It's like Pavlov's dog, you know, he'd hear the cocking, he'd go, oh, I'm up. Paying your bills. Having some money in savings. Think of the Proverbs. Well, I don't want to be a materialist. Okay, I get that. Having some savings in case your car breaks down, it's not being materialistic. What's being materialistic is spending your money on Chipotle and cigarettes and craft beer every week, and you don't have savings. That's materialistic. The person who's being wise, putting money aside a little bit, giving a lot, as one counselor explained it to me, basically you give a good chunk off the top, you save off the bottom, and you try and make that middle portion as small as possible. So you cut out the fast food. You cut out the meaningless expenditures. And you don't become a miserly type where you don't ever go out to the movies, you don't ever have fun, you know, drink a good beer or something. But you're just not wasting frivolously your money. Paying your bills, having money for that. Passing your classes. Oh, does it kill me to hear parents in our fellowship saying, I'm paying for my kids' schooling out of pocket, and they're failing. Oh, does that hurt? Thousands of dollars being wasted. Well, I'm so busy out there serving the Lord. Brother, you can do that, and you can pass your classes. I'm not saying that you have to be a fanatic. If you're failing, just getting it up to a C would be pretty good, getting the credit, moving on with your life. What a waste of time and money. You know, every time you push back graduation, you're pushing back having a salary. Do you realize that? I feel a little bit like a hypocrite preaching on this so hard. It took me 6-7 years to get through my undergrad. I would work one quarter, take off the next. I hated school. Couldn't do it. Take off the next. Work another quarter, take off the next. And prolonged it out. I remember sitting down with a loved one and they were like, you know, every time you take off a quarter, that's another quarter that you're not going to be making 40 grand in a career. Oh, I hate that. She was right. She was right. Getting this finished, get through school, get done with it. Passing your classes. Not going into debt. Credit card debt. Bad. Worse than car debt. Somehow worse. Car debt, the worst. Terrible investment. Brand new car. Awful. If you buy a 2018 car today and it's $30,000, you drive it off the lot, guess how much it's worth? That second you drive it off the lot, it depreciates 10%. It's now worth $27,000. Car dealerships actually sell gap insurance. So if you were to drive it right off the lot and you got into a wreck, they would cover the gap because you already owe them $3,000 if it was totaled. Cars depreciate down to a third of the cost after 5 years. So instead of a 2018, if you got a 2013, that'd be a $10,000 car. And it levels out from there. So getting into debt, not being able to pay your bills, basic hygiene, yeah. Showing up to work with bedhead and bad breath and you haven't showered in a week. That's not Cosmion. That's not the kind of person that people look at and they say, oh man, that just evokes admiration. He's so cool. What's that smell? Oh, the smell of sleeping in his own filth for a week. Oh, that musk of just disgusting, dank body odor. Love it. Hospitable. The word here is philoxenos. Philo, xenos. Phileo, to love. Xenos. Stranger. Philoxenos. Hospitable. So this isn't just referring to putting out veggies and chips, drinks when people come over. It's not less than that. It's definitely more than that. Definitely more. To be hospitable means that you meet, you talk to, you're warm with people who don't know Jesus Christ. Strangers is the word that Paul uses. It means that if you see, you know, maybe your roommate has a friend, you don't know who they are, you never met them. They might be a Christian, they might not, doesn't matter. You're warm. You're friendly. Letting your stuff being used for ministry. Not being a Nazi. Oh, that's my stuff, and it's been mistreated. A lot of people, especially men, they take it as an act of disrespect personally. If you break their stuff, misuse their stuff, there's a lot of ego wrapped up in it. You've hurt me personally. Yeah, that happens, and yet we can all see what it's like to see people on the deep end of this. You feel like, what was the one married couple I remember? They had met with me for some counseling, and they said, we can't get people in our home group to come over to visit. We're trying to get people to come over to hang out. They won't come over. And I knew why. I had talked to people in their group. I said, well, it's because when people walk into your house, it feels like a museum. You make them take off their shoes at the door, and they're like, well, you know, we don't want it to get all dirty and stuff. And I'm like, people are dirty. You're letting people into your house, which means you're letting dirt into your house. You don't let them put their feet up on the coffee table. They have to use coasters. Oh, you can't use those cups. You got to use these cups. And it puts a chill. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too hardcore there, but people love coming over to our house. I'll tell you that. Because they just, you know, put their feet up, relax. Our stuff is inexpensive. We don't care if there's stains on the table. That table, we bought that on Craigslist for a dollar, okay? We found it in a dump. Who cares? And the real question here is, do I love people or do I love things? And you might think that that's too binary, too black and white, whatever. You can sit at home lonely. I'd rather have people, friends in and out of our house like it's a family all the time, have a warm, loving home where our stuff gets messed up from time to time. Christianese is not loving the stranger. That is unloving. When you talk in your Christian language, you know what I mean by Christianese? It's a strange language that only Christians speak, right? What's that word mean? I don't know. It's a different weird language they're using. You people who use Christianese, it's not just a faux pas, it's unloving. Do you realize you're making people feel stupid? You're making people feel excluded. I got this video here. This is actually kind of interesting. This guy sits down with a few of his non-Christian friends. It's a BuzzFeed video, so I don't know how realistic it is. But he gives them a bunch of Christianese words and says, what do you think this means? They have no idea.
As a Christian, I understand that I've been taught a specific set of terminology that is not understandable. I'm going to bring some of these terms to my friends here and see if they know, if they can guess what we're talking about. What do you do if you're giving a love offering?
Sex, sex, sex.
Sounds like an orgy.
Can be what I initially think.
Yeah. Open your arms to someone?
The answer we've come up with is the sign of peace, either a hug or a handshake.
Wrong.
Damn it.
The answer is actually when someone comes to your church as like an evangelist or a preacher and you can't pay them, so you pass around the bucket and you give them a love offering of money.
So money equals love.
What is happening when someone is being washed in the blood?
That's horrifying. Does the water represent blood in a baptism?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
When you're drunk on wine.
Yeah, maybe like absolved of sin.
I don't know. Washed in the blood, that's totally contradictory. I mean, you can't wash something in blood.
Baptism.
Kind of.
We got kind of! Yeah.
Washed clean, washed in the blood, because his sacrifice he made for us, it makes us clean. If you look at someone and you're not seeing the fruit, what is happening?
Whoa.
Okay. They have clothes on.
Oh,
you can't
the fruit of the loins? No, fruit of the loins.
I know
the loins is their children.
Why? Why wouldn't you see a fruit?
Or maybe they don't have enough fruit?
Fruit, yeah.
Then they're a bad egg.
Yeah.
Oh.
They have no God in them.
Fruit of the Spirit in Galatians is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. So if you claim to be a Christian and you're murdering someone...
You ain't got no fruit.
Right? Is that right?
even if you're not religious, maybe you grow up and hear your mom or someone saying those words, so you think, like, everybody knows what that means and you use it, and then people are like, I don't know what they're talking about.
Groups have their own lingo and language and terms for things because they're inclusive. You know, anyone from the outside is obviously going to, you know, question those things.
Yeah, I like that. This is going to happen. Every church culture has it. The point is to stop it. Stop doing it. You're weirding people out. What are some ways we might help a shy or perhaps awkward person to build warm, loving relationships? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, just a buddy of yours who's a believer, who's painfully shy, awkward, has relational problems. You can see it. Everyone can see it. And yet you see they have a heart to love people. How do you help them? Yeah, that's good. I got a buddy who did that. He would get up to teach the Bible. After the Bible study was over, he would just beeline for the door. He had to leave. And really loving man. And apparently a friend of his said, dude, you're such a good guy. You have so much to offer. You're funny, you're smart, and everything else. Why don't you just stand with me? You don't have to talk. I'll help you, you know, and just kind of do what I do. And it really helped him get past that fear of being involved relationally with people. Yeah. Okay. Maybe starting real specific. I think concrete steps are very helpful. Why don't you try and start with this person, a scary person. That's interesting you chose that. Why scary? Why not someone who's easy?
Not scary at all.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's good. Okay, so if they're scary, you kind of throw them in the deep end, and then they realize he's not scary. It's good, okay? Yeah, to be listened to is to be loved. If you feel too shy, one thing you can do is just ask questions, and maybe coaching them on what those questions would be, because the shy person hates silences. They're too awkward. Wouldn't want to feel awkward for 20 seconds, so that would just be awful, yeah. Yeah. Good. You start to realize what works, you start to realize what doesn't work, and you pick up on this. It's more caught than taught, you might say. Yeah.
I have a friend being around people.
Yeah. I like seeing at those card games where the shy person, you know, somebody breaks the rules or messes them up and they're like, "You idiot, you know, I hate you." And you're like, "Oh, that's good. You expressed hate, you know." But it kind of shows we're comfortable now. We can have fun together. Yeah. Yeah. So not just letting them sit there in their squalor and get more and more uncomfortable. When they pull out that phone and they start flipping through whatever, you just have to jump in there. And what you're going to have to do is just talk through the phone. They're going to keep looking at their phone until they realize this person wants to talk to me. And I just keep making eye contact, keep talking to them until the phone goes in the pocket. And don't quit. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. There's some practical components here too. Dale Carnegie's book, have you ever read that book? How to Win Friends and Influence People? Yeah, he's not a believer. He wrote it back in the 30s, I think. It was at a time where there was a general regard for the Bible, so he, you know, will quote the Bible when it serves his purposes from time to time. But a very, very good book. Very simple stuff. Not that complex. Like, smile. When you walk into a room, you see people, you're not like me, my natural face. Oh man, it's bad. It's ugly. It's mean. I look angry. Get me on the computer. It's just, I look like, have you ever seen Terminator 2, T-1000? Looking for John Connor to end the human rebellion, you know? That's just how I look. And realizing what my face looks like, I've got to come into the room and I have to actively move the muscles in my face to smile. Looking people in the eye, shaking their hand, remembering people's names. I mean, these are all things that you're like, oh, they know how to do that. No, they don't. Our culture is completely handicapped relationally. Most people have been building a relationship with a screen for 18, 20 years. That's how they were raised. That's how they communicated. And they need the basic relational skills that when somebody shares something, they change their face. And they, and they give verbal cues. They don't stand here like this. And teach them that kind of stuff. They need that. Speaking of teaching, able to teach for eldership. Not the best translation. Didaktikos literally means, according to BDAG, quote, apt and skillful in teaching. Not just able, but skillful at it. This wouldn't necessarily mean gifted at teaching to be an overseer or an elder. If you don't have that gifting, that's okay. This is the closest attribute we get to gifting in the list of qualifications for an elder. And even this one isn't a gifting. Teaching is a skill. It can be learned. You might not be a 10 teacher, but you could surely be a 6 or a 7, maybe even an 8 kind of a teacher. Oh, you know who was thought of as being the worst, most boring teacher? A man who would start new Bible studies. They'd be in the 40s. He would take over the Bible study and he would start to teach every week and the group would dwindle and die and atrophy until it got down to 2 people. That happened 2 or 3 times in a row. Gary DeLashman. He would take over a Bible study. It was so painfully boring that these high school students would just be like, I am out of here. And he failed a couple groups, and now Dennis regards him as the best Bible teacher this side of the Mississippi River, which I always thought was a funny term, like we're in the Wild West or something, you know. But it could be that a gifting is revealed later, like in his case. It could be that you learn the skills and you become better and better at this until all of a sudden you realize I can teach. Are you a learner? That should be a question you should ask yourself. Are you a reader? Why are the best teachers learners? Why are the best teachers readers? As one public speaker put it, he said, all of the best public speaking begins with private reading, private study. How are you going to teach if you don't have anything to say? I know some people who are really extroverted, they can just really get up there and it's like comedy hour. They are just rolling with the jokes and telling stories and you're laughing and then you're crying and you don't know why. You feel like you're going through menopause or something. You're like, this guy's so charismatic. This is so incredible. And then you're like, what did he teach? I don't even know. All flair, no substance. Learn. Become a reader. Study. Prepare. I usually feel nervous to teach until I start my prep. Once I start getting my prep going for teaching, let's say I'm going to teach at the Summer Institute or something, I get nervous about that. I'm thinking, what the heck am I going to say? It's going to be stupid. No one's going to like what I'm sharing until I start to study and I start to prep and I start to get these points and I'm like, oh, that's a good point. That's going to land. Oh, I'm thinking of this person. They need to hear that. And you start to prepare. And this is one of the ways that you become a better teacher is you're not coming in half-cocked, not doing the work because, oh, you're so gifted and everything else. Well, congratulations. You're gifted and you're not using it. So, great job. Jesus says to the person with 5 talents, he brings in 5 talents. That's what he expects. So if you feel like you're such a hotshot teacher, well, he's going to expect more of you, which means preparation and study. Study. This can be learned. Some people aren't gifted lecturers. That's okay. I know some people, I just look at them and I don't want to make God small or something, but I'm just like, they are never going to be a good lecturer. I've been proven wrong on that, by the way. But I've met some people like that, and yet I've taught them how to teach through discussion. One person after another, not a good lecturer, but they can lead a good discussion, which is powerful, exciting, funny. And some people that, you know, have less personality than that table, lead a good discussion and they're funny and witty and everything else. And it's like, that's a skillful teacher. Good job. Teaching. Not addicted to wine. Mei in the Greek is not. Poroinon means literally not a drunk. BDAG, one who is given to drinking too much wine, addicted to wine, drunken. This doesn't mean that you can't drink wine. can't drink alcohol. In 1 Timothy 5:23, Paul says, drink a little bit of wine to Timothy. Paul says of deacons, they should not be addicted to much wine. Like, should we be addicted to any wine? I don't know what he means by that exactly, but not addicted, not dependent on it. This would be similar to drug dependency, where it's putting you in an unsober state. It's not like medicine. I know people have said, well, you have your coffee every morning. No, that's a stimulant. Alcohol, drugs, those are hallucinogens, they're depressants. They mess up, they inhibit your mental faculty. That is categorically different. A sign to check here would be if you're able to give up your freedom in Christ to drink. We have examples where high school students, when they come down to campus, it's okay if we drink, but what if a parent was saying, I don't want my son or daughter to go on campus with college people drinking? What's your move? You could say, well, we're not getting drunk. We will definitely not give alcohol to an underager, period. I mean, you could argue your case, sure, but what if they're just like, no, I don't want my kid being around alcohol? What do? You don't drink. It's between me having a beer or two and this student being able to come out for that weekend, no contest. And people who gripe and complain about that, that makes me wonder. You can't put this down? You don't feel like you can put it down for the sake of somebody? People who feel like they have to have alcohol at every social function just to relate. One girl was telling me, I feel like I need to have a beer or two. I said, why? She said, well, I just don't feel like I can connect with people unless I have a couple beers. You know, that's a dangerous place to be in. If you don't feel like the Holy Spirit can work through you to connect with His people unless you have a beer or two. There's something fundamentally broken about that. And if we're seeing every time there's a social gathering, I gotta be drinking, that's a sign. Being able to deal with your stress properly, we should work into our schedules, into our life, ways to deal with stress. Rewards. For me, it's right after a really big spiritual victory. You know, maybe I'll teach a big meeting and feel really excited about that, and you hear about people coming to Christ, and God, I love that. But leading up to that meeting was 2 weeks of stress and preparation and getting pounded on by the evil one. And then it's over and Satan leaves you, or so you think. And then all of a sudden you haven't dealt with that stress, and so you're looking for a reward. And so we need to work into our schedule. Okay, I got this big weekend. I'm going to plan a vacation after it. Or I'm going to plan a couple days to recover. Or one guy I was talking to, he doesn't eat sweets and stuff like that, but he says, if I'm looking for a reward, I get a pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. And he said, I put that in the freezer, and I say, that's my reward. Maybe a good movie, something to unwind. Better than drinking, that's for sure. Seeking stimulation from God. Paul says, do not be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Holy Spirit, making melody in your hearts. Being filled with the Holy Spirit is stimulating. And Paul seems to be saying that those two concepts, being drunk with wine and being stimulated, filled, excited, making melody in your hearts by the Holy Spirit, those two things are mutually exclusive. So I got to ask myself, do I want to be filled with the Spirit to make an impact on others, get my sense of stimulation, excitement from Him, knowing Him deeper? Or am I going to get that from alcohol, drug dependency? An area to check would be that you could admit that you had too much. Do you have to wait until you're hugging the porcelain toilet, puking, before you can just admit, under grace, I had too much to drink? Wouldn't it be okay if your roommate came to you and said, you know, I don't know if I was drunk last night, but I definitely didn't feel sober. I just need to get that off my conscience. That'd be great. Again, do we have to wait until we have a fall before we can admit I want to cross the line? Admitting that, being honest about it. Not pugnacious. I love that word. I always think of a pug dog, which are the least pugnacious creatures on earth. Pug. But pugnacious, like a dog. Me plectes means literally not a hitter, not a striker. Pugnacious person, a bully. The kind of person that is bullying to get their way. Let's go through a few of these. Gentle. Epieikes means, quote, not insisting on every right of letter of law or custom, yielding, gentle, kind, courteous, tolerant. So these are paired together, not a striker, but gentle, not insisting on every right of letter of law, that I'm going to get what I want, is the attitude. It's the opposite of that. Areas to check here would be that we're easy to please. If people are constantly getting the attitude, oh, I could never do enough, he's never happy with me, he never thinks I'm doing a good job, never encourages, never kind, that's a problem. You know, Francis Schaeffer used to put it, if we're waiting for perfection or nothing, we will always get nothing. Being a person who's easy to please, that you see effort, you see faithfulness, it was kind of ugly, it was not that good, and yet, good job. Like I shared before, first-time teachers, you know, after the teaching, they usually come up and say, how'd I do, how'd I do, how'd I do? And usually a first-time teacher is not that good. And yet, being able to look through that and say, man, I think I see some potential here. This is good. You should have heard my first teaching. it was almost as bad as my second teaching, my second home church teaching, way worse. Halfway through the teaching, I wished I could have just gotten up and left the seat and sat in the front row, or maybe like gone to the bathroom and cried or something. I mean, it was so bad, painful. And yet, people, very easy to please. Good job. I like this point, like that. Not always taking a hard line. If there's a spectrum of judgment calls to make, you're always taking the hardest one. It's never good enough. It's never right. People can be really fragile. You wouldn't believe the memories that people can recall fairly quickly with regard to the words people used with them. I'm talking about years later. I can still remember specific insults, kind of demeaning things that people said, and when it comes from a leader, someone you respect, browbeating, insulting, something like that, that can stick with you for a long time. And so we need to give people dignity. And even if we're kind of a bulldozer type of a person, we need to hold back. We could show a display of authority, of strength, and yet we're holding back from that. We're not going to. We're going to be gentle. There are some things you ought never to say. Cussing somebody out. I believe in prioritized ethics, so I don't view cussing as a big deal, frankly. But cussing in an argument, cussing when you're trying to correct another believer, name calling, that is totally out of the question. Remember talking to a married couple, how about this? The woman, in a fit of anger, turned to her husband and said, I was happier before we were married. And then, a day later, she asked for forgiveness, and they were made up, and the husband gave the forgiveness to her. But you don't think he's going to remember that? You know, the attitude of, I'm just going to say whatever I feel like, and then later I ask for forgiveness. Okay, there is forgiveness, but trust has been broken. You've just shattered the framework of this person with your words. And I don't know what you need to do, but you need to stop talking and you need to leave the room before you say something that you ought not say. Peaceable. Not just being a peaceful person, as though it's saying something about yourself, but being a person who promotes peace. That you're seeing disruption, that you're seeing hatred, bitterness. How did Jesus put it? Matthew 5, what is it, verse 9, I think. Blessed are the peacemakers, they shall be called children of God. So a person who's looking for this, seeing that there's anger, distrust, and that they're moving in to mediate. It doesn't have to be formal. Most of this is you talk to him and you talk to her and you urge him to go back. And what about saying this? And what about apologizing? What about asking for forgiveness here or there? That's a big part of leadership. So it's an illusion that we're going to not see conflict. We will see conflict. But we need to work through these conflicts to glorify God. Peaceable would also involve that I'm not creating the disruption of peace. Somebody who uses what we call pyrotechnics. That's where I'm starting to get closer and closer on an issue. Maybe I'm asking questions. And all of a sudden you just blow up. You storm out of the room. You fight back. What is that? That is punishing behavior. That's what that is. We're trying to talk. Yes, it's serious. No, I don't like having these conversations. Yeah, we're trying to talk, and then all of a sudden you blow up. Basically, what that's communicating is, I don't want to talk about this, and so I'm going to punish you with the hopes that you're going to retreat. It's like some people say, if you see a certain kind of bear in the woods, I don't know which kind, but one of the kinds, you're supposed to stand up and scream and yell, and hopefully it'll scare off the bear. And that's basically, it's an infantile behavior, but that's what people are thinking. The other option is people just break into tears. And, of course, we have a category for talking to somebody about something, and tears are shed. And as I said, people are fragile. We have to be gentle and work through it. And yet, if I'm noticing, every time we talk about this issue, this person breaks into tears, and then we never talk about it. What is that? I just got manipulated. Many people grew up in homes where they learned if I just cry and let out the waterworks, the parent will back away. And that's my way of dealing with conflict. And so what we need to do, psychologists will say that when people are flooded, is what they call it, your emotions are spiking, your heart rate is up, you're worked up, you can't think, pyrotechnics, crying, bitterness, shutting down, stonewalling is what John Gottman calls it. You just won't talk. What do you mean you won't talk? We're talking. What you do is, psychologists say, people will flood, but give them 20 minutes. 20 minutes is the magic number. You don't want to give them a day or two. You just say, okay, I can see you're upset. Take a minute. I get it. And if you need to walk out of the room, take a break. But we still need to talk about this. Let them calm down, get the heart rate back down, and then we're going to have a discussion, and then they discover we can have a hard talk, and it actually feels pretty good once it's over with. We got our stuff out on the table, we talked through it like adults, and they discover that instead of punishing people, they can actually become peaceful with people, and it feels a lot better. How does it make you feel when one of your roommates, or maybe a co-leader, throws a temper tantrum like this? Or they stonewall. They just stop talking. How serious should we consider episodes like this? I treat this as pretty serious. Having somebody blow up on everybody. And what? So we're just supposed to pick up the pieces every time you do this? Do you see how this is affecting everybody here? How are we supposed to... When we talk about close love relationships, that becomes a farce if you're just going to come in here and stomp on that. We're not going to tolerate that. Yeah. Bad, 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 bad. Free from the love of money. Ah is the privation, the not, like atheist, atheist. Phileo, love. And argos, argaros, silver. Not a lover of silver. Areas to check here. Am I a model to other people? In leadership, you stop thinking about what is okay for me to do. You start thinking about what would I want my people to do? They're looking to me. You know, we have the passages in the New Testament about what it means to not be a lover of money and not be a materialist and the rich fool. What does that look like? Does that look like selling all my clothes and wearing rags? Does it look like living in a hobbit hole that I dug in the ground. How far are we supposed to go? There's a law that the effect doesn't rise above the cause. People typically don't go farther than their leaders. I wish they did, and we should. And yet, when you think about a model of what it looks like to be free from the love of money, that's kind of hard to discern. They usually follow your model or worse. And so you need to think about that. Well, I can afford this or I can afford that. Yeah, but you're setting a precedent for your people. Stop thinking about what you can do and think about what would be healthy for the people around you. Being a generous giver, when you think about an antidote for materialism, this is probably the best one, is to generously give each year, making a goal. We're going to increase our giving a little bit more. And living simply, simple living. I really believe in that. Not going overboard. Well, we can afford it. Yeah, but we don't need that. Why do we need that? As Christians, we believe that happiness comes from the relational side of life, not from the material side. And so simple living. You enjoy your life more. You don't need it. If it gets broken, not a big deal. He must be one who manages his own household well. Oh, that's a bad translation. Manages, leads. You're a manager of your household, like manager of a Walmart. No, it's relational here. Keeping his children under control with all dignity. Yeah, controlling your kids. Keeping his children under control with all dignity. Here is the crucial part here. The terms used here are pretty strong. In Greek, they're terms used for leadership, like servant leadership in the church. It's the same principle at home. With all dignity, dignity, this is the real key prepositional phrase. Semnotes, dignity, means, quote, one who is above what is ordinary and therefore worthy of special respect. Oh, that's a good picture there. Why do we listen to Dad? Why do we listen to Mom? We respect her. We love her. She doesn't let us down. She's worthy of our respect. It seems to me that the best model for parenting is the relational model, where we build a, like leadership, like any other kind of leadership, we build a relationship with the child, and they love us, and they want to listen to us. I can't tell you how many people I've met from Christian homes where it was just imperative after imperative after imperative, and don't do this and do that and everything else, and these kids didn't love their parents, weren't close with them. My one buddy used to say he'd be out at the party and the joint would be coming around the circle, and he'd be looking at that, and it would come to him, and he would say, boy, if I smoke this joint, that is really going to piss off my dad, who I hate. Sure enough, you'd smoke that joint. Why listen to someone you hate? So worthy of respect. This would be done through servant love, modeling, persuasion. I know you guys aren't here yet. You will be. In the home, having a good leadership in the home. It's really the same principles you use for any other kind of leadership. This sort of thing is a lot easier to fake with strangers. Ajith Fernando, in his book on family life of a Christian minister, he says, you know, what if I treated the people in my church the way I treated my spouse? And then vice versa. What if I treated my spouse the way I treat people in my church? You know, people in your ministry, they could be saying the nastiest things to you. You've got yourself under control. You're being patient, you're being sweet, you're being kind, and yet if your spouse, somebody like that, said the same thing to you, you go off on them. Mark Driscoll, for all of his faults, used to say that when he would try and decide if he was going to send out a new church planter, he would invite the wife in, just her, and he would interview her for an hour. Does he love you? Does he love the kids? Does he read the Bible with you? Does he pray with you? How's date night? And he would get her perspective. And he said, I had a few times where I would be interviewing a pastor's wife, And I'd get into two or three of those questions and she would burst into tears. And that was pretty telling. I mean, you can fake a lot of ministry out here, but at home base, it's easier to show your true colors. Are we investing in our family or are we a workaholic? This could be true for your job. The case of the one Christian kid, 20 years old, guy was talking to him, asking him questions. He had this pernicious doubt. The guy who was leading him said, so your dad, he's a believer. You ever talk to him about this? He said, no. He said, really? You ever talk to him about spiritual stuff? No. Never? You never studied anything together? Never prayed together? The guy couldn't think of a single time he'd ever prayed or talked about spiritual things with his own father. Why? Well, dad was too busy. Dad is out in the workshop building things. He's at work. He's doing his hobbies. He's too busy on the television, the computer. That's unacceptable for a leader. Taking care of your family, raising your kids in a way where they love following the Lord. They see the impact on you. There's going to be times where, you know, you're going to need help. Your spouse is going to be losing it. Your kids are going to be losing it. The litmus test here is, are you asking for the help before they go overboard? This is a bad sign when you talk to people and they say, well, yeah, basically my marriage is falling apart. When did this start? Well, it started about 2.5 years ago. Well, that's about 2.5 years too late. Now what are we going to do? It's like the difference between finding a lump and then finding a fully metastasized tumor. Now I don't know what we're going to do. Send you into surgery, do chemotherapy. We're in trouble here. Hopefully we can salvage this, but why wouldn't you reach out? Why wouldn't you say anything? In our church, we argue that for children who are adults, elders who have children who are adults who rebel, we believe that that does not de facto mean that they're discredited for eldership. Adults can choose to follow the Lord or not. But children with, or adults, elders with little kids at home, neglecting them, not present. They're out doing ministry all the time. That's unacceptable. That would be disqualifying. There's the famous case of John Piper out in a Bethlehem church. One of his adult children walked away from the Lord, left fellowship. He showed up that week with his resignation letter and said, if the elders here think that I should resign, I will. They rejected it, his resignation. They had felt like he had done his best to work with his son, love his son, and so forth. I don't know. I'm not part of it. But we'd like to be able to see that if somebody's kid walks away from the Lord, that we could see they tried. They did their best. Again, you're not here. You will be. 90% of you are going to have kids. And to see your kid lose their walk with God would have to be one of the most painful things you could go through. So you got to do whatever you can to prepare for that. But, Paul says, if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? That's kind of an interesting point. Later he calls the church the household of the living God. How are you supposed to lead if you can't lead at home? Not a new convert, he says. Me neophutos means not newly planted. Not newly planted, like a neophyte, a new newbie. Not a new convert. Of course, this is relative to the group. Paul says that Timothy was a young man. Let no one look down on you for your youthfulness. That could have been as young as 30 or even 40, based on the definition of that term. But he was definitely younger than the people he was leading. It shouldn't be based on seniority. We don't practice that. We had the case of a guy, unloving, mean-spirited, legalistic. He was the oldest guy in their house. And instead, we put the two 19-year-old guys into house leadership over him. He couldn't handle that. He left fellowship over that. That bothered him that much. He felt like, I'm older, I know more, and so forth. Well, then he left fellowship. That doesn't help his case. I felt like that was the right move, because what if we had somebody in there who was a hireling? Go with the person who has the character and the fruit and the faithfulness. never go on while they've been around longer. Bad idea. Yet, on the other hand, I think specifically for elders, you don't want to have a new, brand new convert. He says he must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. So, it's not just inside the church. Above reproach, inside and outside. Not being two-faced. You know, what would your neighbor say about you? Think about that. Your neighbors, they think you're the worst people on the block. Hate the fact that you guys moved in there. They have young kids who are trying to sleep at night and you're up screaming and yelling till 2 a.m. on the porch. Not having a good reputation with those outside the church. This would also imply that the leader is sensitive to what non-Christian people are doing, thinking, or into. If you're at your job, if you're at school. We used to have an old lady that lived on the corner. She didn't like us. There was always people hanging out late, lots of cars taking up her spots, you know. And the one week, my buddy went over and talked to her on the corner. And he said, you know, I saw that you had a bunch of spray paint on your brick around your house. She said, yeah. He said, well, we got a pressure washer. We could wash that off for you. We could paint that brick too if you wanted it. Oh, she just about went into a delirium. Then he said, you know, we're up really late at night in our house. I'm sure you've noticed. I mean, we're up till 1, 2 a.m. She's like, yeah. He's like, we'll watch your house for you. If we see anybody with spray paint cans, we're going to come out there. Titus 1:6. As any man is above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion, for the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not self-willed. Me-a-theta means self-willed, stubborn, or arrogant. Areas to check. Being able to defer to other people. Deference. It's not my idea. I have a different idea, and yet I'm going with her idea. Being able to ask for help. Not self-willed. We have a proverb in our fellowship. Everyone gets their say, but not everyone gets their way. I like that. You get your say, but not necessarily your way. In leadership teams, if you're expecting every time for people to go with your idea, that's not going to work like that. That's not how leadership works. Supporting other people's ideas. It's not just that I'm acquiescing to what you say or what you think. It's that I'm saying I'm going to go with your way and I'm going to support it. I'm not going to hope that it fails. I'm not going to nitpick it. Be negative. Being able to apologize. The strong-willed person, self-willed person, needs to apologize. You know, I came on too strong. I wasn't listening. I'm sorry. I'm going to try to do better. How would you differentiate between being self-willed and being strong-willed? What do you think is the difference between the two? Yeah. Was Jesus strong-willed? Was he a strong-willed man? Yes. Was Paul a strong-willed man? Yes. We don't want to turn people into weaklings. We don't want to turn them into weak-willed people. It's bad. But likewise, we don't want to turn them into self-willed people. That is just as bad. Very bad. Destructive. So the question is, are they standing up for their way or are they trying to stand up for God's way? That'd be one difference. That's good. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Although I can think of times where a strong-willed person would be aggressive and would be pretty tenacious. It's subtle, the difference. Yeah. That's good. It isn't just that they're willfully pushing it through. Or a strong-willed person could be supporting somebody else's idea. Why? Because they think it's right. Yeah, that's a good key difference. Yeah? I think the motivation is it important? The self-willed person always makes every issue a 10 out of 10. It's like the flare just goes straight up. Everything's important. Controlling, pushing, manipulating. The strong-willed person is willing to defer when things aren't important. And, okay, let's do it your way. Let's try your way. And yet when something is important, they will put their foot down and say, no, I really don't agree with that. I can't agree with that. I don't see it. Yeah. 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 Scripture or reason that I don't see that. How would that be good? Yeah. How about this as a determiner? That the self-willed person could be doing it for their own interest, whereas the strong-willed person is doing it for the interest of others. Why are they being so upset about this? Because they care. They care about the state of people's lives. Not quick-tempered. Me orgilon, orge, wrath, inclined to anger, quick-tempered. Areas to check here, that you're slow to anger. It's not impulsive. Your anger is under control. That in times where you even have to rebuke or correct, that you've got yourself under control. The Bible isn't against anger. What it's against is unrighteous anger, abusing people. I typically pray before I go and bring a strong word to somebody, God, please help me from losing my temper, from name-calling, insulting, anything like that. I don't want to go down that route. And yet, being calm and cool, and if you got to raise your voice and make a display of anger, you're able to do that. But it's controlled. You're able to pull it right back to where you were. Not representing God as angrier than he is. That was the sin of Moses. He made it seem like God was really angry with the people, and God says, actually, I'm angry with you. Because you represented me that way. You're not going into the promised land. Numbers chapter 20. Loving what is good. Loving what is good. Having a critique of culture. Yet not being self-righteous. You see a lot of leaders that, especially if you listen to Christian radio, Christian podcasts, they have a good critique of culture, and yet there's a self-righteous bent to it. Anything that's secular, bad, they can't understand it. They can't think through it. The best way to teach your kid not to drown is not to keep him from water. It's to teach him how to swim. And good leaders love what is good, and they can teach people discernment, how to think through it from the other perspective. Just. Areas to check would be that the person is fair, impartial. They're not just going with their buddy. Why is it that it's always you're trying to push your people forward? What about the other people around here? Nepotism, you know what that is? That's where you're trying to, you know, push your brother, your spouse, your kids. Why? Well, because you have authority and you're trying to push them up. The same thing would be true for reverse nepotism. You're too weak to promote someone that you love because you're afraid that people are going to criticize you for it. No, I'm promoting this person. Yeah, they happen to be close to me because I think they're the best person. And I might be criticized for that, whatever. I want to do what's right. I want to do what's just, what's best for the group. Devout, hasios, means to be committed to and serious about spiritual matters. Yeah, zealous, you might say. Zealous, I like that word. Excited, the way you talk about the things of God motivates people. The way you talk about your inner life with the Lord. I'm not talking about being a cheerleader, okay? This is so awesome all the time. Give me an A. A, you know, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the way you talk about spiritual things is exciting and people, well, they feel that there's a certain contagiousness to it. That when I'm around that girl, when I'm around that guy and they talk about spiritual stuff, I can't help but get excited too. You have some hasios in your life. Not walking around, acting like you're drained by serving God, like you're some kind of martyr for serving the Lord. What's wrong with you? Oh, I'm so tired all the time. And what are you communicating to people? You're communicating, don't become like me. That's what you're communicating. Zeal, you lose it from time to time. One of the best ways you can get it back is intentionally get around zealous people. I remember a time when our home church was doing very poorly. And I used to go over on a Tuesday night to another home church leader's house. He would have people over, and I would just get him to talk about his group and talk about people. And he was kind of an intense personality, excited. And he would talk about this and talk about that. And I would go over there. I would get recharged, and I'd bring it right back in to our group. Reading biographies of Christian men and women can be very exciting. I know it sounds boring. You start to read it and you're like, they were doing the same thing I'm trying to do. They went through worse discouragement. The story of William Carey translating a whole Bible into a native language, coming back to his workshop and found that the whole thing was burned to a crisp. That was before Dropbox, right? The next morning, they found William Carey in another study translating Genesis 1-1. They said, what are you doing? He said, well, I better keep translating. He called himself a plotter. He would just keep plodding along. He translated the Bible into some 30 languages on his own. He's one of the fathers of the modern missions movement. Not that gifted of a man when you study about him. And you read about him. Chuck Smith is another one. You read his biography and you're like, God, and it's motivating. It brings zeal. And there's probably more that could be said there, but we're on verse 9. Holding fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able to both exhort in sound doctrine and refute those who contradict. Not just teaching the truth, but knowing how to refute error. Not just knowing what. Well, we believe in the hypostatic union, and we believe in the Trinity, and we believe in the incarnation, and we believe in grace, and we believe in such and such. No, we also have to know how to refute Arianism, Docetism, heresies, false teaching, other worldviews. This involves doing the academic reading. Some people just refuse to do this. They cry about it. Why are we reading Gleason Archer? Why are we studying William Lane Craig? Why are we doing G. Ernest Wright? Why are we doing this and that? And it's hard. And the reason it's hard is because it's like a muscle. You could go on the elliptical, okay? You can do that. And you can get your heart rate up. Good for you. What we're doing here is we're putting you under 500 pounds of pure metal. And you got to lift that up off your chest or be crushed by it, okay? That's why. And we're straining you, we're pulling you, and you get through one of these academic readings, I'm saying probably 10% sticks to the wall. And yet you do it again with another book, 20% sticks, no. Another book, 30%, and then all of a sudden you start reading it, and it's like reading a foreign language. It starts to make sense, you start to get into it, and then you can do deeper and deeper study. Most disciple makers stick on the devotional reading. They stick on the simple, basic stuff. And it isn't any wonder that their people don't bear a lot of fruit, because they've only been given the milk. We need to get into the meat. Not making straw man arguments. You know what those are. It's a fallacy. That's where you invent a fake straw man of your opponent's position. Then you kill the straw man and your opponents over here untouched. Like I heard the story of the guy who said, yeah, I don't believe in evolution. Why not? Well, cause if we evolved from monkeys, then why are there still monkeys? you have not studied this, have you? No. Well, you know, how can one thing give birth to another? Makes no sense. You have not studied this. It shows that you are weak academically. So we got to do this study. What about deacons? Deacons have 11 character qualities rather than 20. Most are the same as elders. The differences seem to be that there's a difference in strength in the word. That is a key difference. And their spiritual age. Not a neophyte, not a new believer, as Paul puts it. There's one unique one. Not double-tongued, and really not malicious gossips. That seems to be similar. Double-tongued and gossip. Gossip is where, well, sometimes in the Bible, it's referred to as slander. That's where you're actually not even telling the truth behind somebody's back. It's you're lying. You're slanderously speaking something that's not true. Gossip would be where you're talking behind somebody's back, not for their benefit. Deacons who get into this, you're getting into trouble. Double-tongued, you say one thing to the person, something different to somebody else. We don't want to be caught doing that. We want our yes to be yes, our no to be no. Anything we would share when the person isn't around, we want to share the same thing to them. So, conclusions. After reading through these qualifications, it's easy to feel embarrassed, pretty ashamed. If you feel that way, how do you think I feel? I'm teaching them. Some of these I'm teaching through and just have a heavy heart. Instead of watering down what the word says, I think we should just teach it the way it says it and all collectively come under its authority. The real issue here is when you think through these character qualities, it isn't your role to change. He's going to bring the character transformation. Our role is to turn to him. That's the only changing we do, is to repent, which means to have a change of heart, and to present ourselves to him and put ourselves in his hands and say, God, I want this to change. It could be that as you go through this character study, if, and I mean could be in the sense like if you have a pulse in your wrist, that you could be feeling challenged to change your character. The question is, are you going to respond to the correction and the conviction that the Holy Spirit is giving you through the Word? Or are you going to deflect it, justify it, say it's really not that bad, and blow it off? Here's my challenge for each one of you. As you look at this list, look at one or maybe two of these which are glaring, which you're saying, that is a showstopper, that is so bad, I'm not here yet. And I want you to pray about that issue, and then I want you to go and share it with somebody. It could be a roommate, it could be a dear friend, and open up about that and say, I want, a year from now, I want to see progress in that area. Don't look at this list and just say, I'm just going to become better at all this stuff. It's not the way it works. God will reveal, there's this issue here, and I want to change that. Finally, remember that we don't make leaders, we recognize them. And yeah, our perception is flawed, we're not perfect. Sometimes we're recognizing a leader that ought not to be recognized. Sometimes we're not recognizing a leader that should be recognized. It's flawed. Instead of focusing on, I should be recognized by now for what a shining star I am, get the focus off of recognition and get the focus onto other people. You don't need the title. Would you rather have the office, the title, or would you rather do the work?